I'd like to continue the discussion of aggregation kinetics. My impression is that yesterday I killed you with a little bit of mathematical physics. So I'm going to try and be a little bit kinder today and try and emphasize the physical aspects and de-emphasize the mathematical aspects. So let me just remind you some facts from last time. I talked about two different types of kinetic processes, one where Kij was equal to 2, so-called constant kernel aggregation. And there we found that the second moment of the mass distribution, which can be thought of as a measure of the mean size of clusters, this is equal to 1 plus 2t. So as the system aggregates, and if every aggregation rate is the same as any other aggregation rate, then the typical cluster size is growing linearly with time. And a second fact from this is that Ck of t, the actual cluster mass distribution in a limit of t going to infinity, had a very simple form, 1 over t squared e to the minus k over t. So from this, there's a characteristic size inside of this distribution, which is growing linearly with time. So the asymptotically exact solution just confirms what we learned by looking at the moments. Then the second thing that I discussed was Kij is equal to ij, the so-called product kernel. And so what the first thing that we learned here is that if I do the same moment analysis, I found that M2 was equal to 1 over 1 minus t. So this suggests that something very bad or very strange is happening as t goes to 1, namely the typical cluster size diverges. So the point is that at t equals 1, there is a gelation transition. So what I want to do today is say a few more. So my goal for today's lecture is I want to say a little bit more about product kernel aggregation. Then I want to spend some time discussing the scaling theory of aggregation, which is one of your homework problems. And then I'm going to talk a little briefly, I hope, about aggregation with input. So those are the three topics I'm going to do today. OK. So what we discussed yesterday was the generating function approach. And here I'm not going to do very many details. I just want to remind you what the answer was. So we define an exponential generating function, EYT, which is equal to the summation from k equals 1 to infinity, kck of t e to the yk. And this generating function transforms the master equations for product kernel aggregation into a partial differential equation. And it turns out to be a very famous partial differential equation in mathematical physics called the Burgers equation. And this problem can be solved by the method of characteristics. And after you solve it, what one finds is the following solution, that E times E to the minus ET is equal to E to the Y minus T. So that is the solution. Now, the thing about the solution is that it's in an implicit form. We want to find E, and if we have E and expand it in a power series, we'll get the cluster concentrations. Here, E is written in an implicit form, and so we have to first invert it to find E explicitly, and then we have to expand it in a power series. The techniques for doing this, I would say, really do involve some black magic. And what I'm going to do, I'm going to not do any of it now, but I'm going to give you now a tutorial problem to think about, and I guess it'll get typed out, but just as a practice, if you have the good old Fibonacci sequence, which many of you have seen, you know, in elementary school, namely you have Fn is defined as Fn minus 1 plus Fn minus 2, and you say that the first term in the series is equal to 1, the second term in the series is equal to 1, and then you can start just iterating. So F2 is equal to 2, F3 is equal to 3, F4 is equal to 5, 8, 13, 21, dot, 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 dot. And so I say, tell me what is the millionth term in the Fibonacci sequence. And so what I'll ask you to do in the tutorial is to use a generating function technique to transform the second order recursion formula, which is like a second order differential equation, into an algebraic equation, solve for the generating function, and then invert the generating function to find the terms. That's like the first baby step in dealing with this thing. So that'll be for the tutorial. Anyways, so the point here is that if I do all of this black magic, of which some of you'll, which you'll learn this afternoon, the answer is remarkably simple, that Ck, the cluster concentration, is equal to k to the power k minus 2 divided by k factorial, t to the power k minus 1 e to the minus kt. So this is the exact answer. And if you look at it, it looks fairly innocuous. It's like smoothly varying functions. You know, what's the big deal about it? And in fact, if you compare it to the exact solution for constant kernel aggregation, it doesn't look, at least to the eye, to be very much different. But in fact, this cluster concentration has all kinds of beautiful mysteries buried inside of it. And so let's just examine what happens, first of all, for t less than 1 and for t equals 1, because all of the action happens when t is equal to 1. So for t less than 1, well, thing is that here we have an exponential decay. And this basically dominates the process. So in this limit, we have that ck is asymptotically e to the minus kt. So we have just an exponential distribution. And this has some important consequences about the nature of the population of clusters that exist in the system. Let's look when t is equal to 1, though, because something magical happens when t is equal to 1. So for t equals 1, let me apply Stirling's approximation over here. And so what I'm going to get then for t equals 1, so I'm going to get k to the power k minus 2. Downstairs, k factorial. So Stirling's approximation would say that this is k over e to the power k times the square root of 2 pi k. That's Stirling's approximation. And if t is 1, we forget about this. And then I have here e to the minus k. And then let's just do a little bit of cancellation. Here I have e to the k in the denominator, which is e to the k upstairs. So that cancels this guy. So that goes away. K to the k cancels the k to the k up here. So that goes away. And then this magically reduces to something very simple, 1 over the square root 2 pi. 1 over k to the power 5 halves. So the distribution changes from being exponential to a power law at t equals 1. And because there is a power law, in this case, the second moment, the mean square value of the mass, this is equal to finite. Whereas here, k squared, so this is equal to the integral of k squared 1 over k to the power 5 halves dk. And when I integrate over the entire range, this is equal to infinity. So here is a signal that, in fact, at t equals 1, the cluster mass distribution has this feature that there's there's a gelation transition happening because the average size of the clusters actually diverges. So I want to spend a little bit of time just delving a little bit more deeply into this notion of gelation. So these two facts suggest that there's gelation at t equals 1. So now, two things that we can say to like investigate this in a little bit more detail is let's look at the largest cluster that exists in a finite population. What is the size of the largest cluster? And you may remember from the very first lecture I asked, like, what is the energy of the hottest molecule in this room? A basic fact in extreme value statistics. We can do the same thing and ask, if these are my asymptotic distributions, what is the largest cluster size? So I imagine now I have a finite population of clusters that aggregate. I want to have the number being very large. And I ask, in this finite population, what's the largest that I can get? And so for t less than 1, I would say that k max, the largest cluster size, is determined by the criterion, as some of you pointed out to me when I first asked this question, that I have to take the integral from k max to infinity of e to the minus k over k, you know, over like an average, I don't know what to call this. Let's just write it e to the minus kt dk, that this integral should be equal to 1 over n. And if you now just estimate this integral, so when I evaluate this integral, I'll get 1 over kt is equal, well, so when I evaluate this integral, I'm going to get here e to the minus k max t is of the order of 1 over n, forgetting about power law factors in front because everything is dominated by the exponential. And from this, I'm going to get that k max is proportional to logarithm of n. So the thing is that if as this gelation process is going on, at early times as clusters are growing, the largest cluster is only logarithmically large in n. And this is a general feature of whenever you have an exponential distribution, that the largest variable from an exponential distribution is only growing logarithmically in the size of the sample. However, for t equals 1, the same criterion would say that I do the integral k max to infinity of k to the minus 5 halves dk equals 1 over n. When I evaluate this integral, I'm going to get k max to the minus 3 halves is of the order of 1 over n, or k max scales as n to the power 2 thirds. So here is a very simple probability theory argument that shows how there's a very fundamental difference between the size distribution below the percolation transition or below the gelation transition and at the transition, where the largest size is log n or n to the 2 thirds. And so here is another signal somehow that something really funny is happening at the gelation transition, that the typical size or the largest size suddenly jumps from only being logarithmically large to power law large. OK. One last point that I want to make about this gelation story is let's go back and look at both the generating function itself and look a little bit more detail at the meaning of the moments of the cluster size distribution. So let's imagine that we have a finite population. Because the problem with studying gelation is that if you have an infant system, what I'd like to say is that starting with a finite population, one can detect the transition in a physically appealing way. So let's imagine we have a finite population of capital M clusters to begin with. So I say I have capital M clusters. I let the system aggregate. If there is gelation, so if gelation occurs, so the picture you should have in mind if I'm plotting, say, ck as a function of k. So you start off with just everybody here at monomer. You start with only this. And as the process develops, now there's some dimers and trimers. And as it continues on, then you get more dimers, trimers, 4, 5. You know, you'll get some distribution, whatever it is. But then somewhere, if there's gelation, then somewhere way out here, you know, there's going to be my population of finite size clusters. But then somewhere way out here is the gel. That's the meaning of gelation, that there's one guy that runs away and has a finite fraction of all the mass in the system. So if I define g here as the, well, yeah, so let me write here. I'm plotting here k. So what is the k of the gel? What is the size of the gel molecule? So let me define this thing. By definition, if a gel exists, it consists of a finite fraction of the entire mass of the system. And therefore, the size of the gel will be something which is going to be proportional to the total number of clusters that I start with times g. So little g here is defined to be the gel fraction. So let's now use this fact to go back and look at the moments of the cluster mass distribution. So remember, we define the moments, mn. This is equal to the summation k to the power n ck. And this summation goes from k equals 1 to infinity. But, you know, again, thinking in terms of writing a sum of this type, and in the long time limit, we would like to turn it into an integral. So when I'm trying to calculate the area under a curve like this, where I have some smooth part to the curve, and then there's nothing, 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 you go way out here, and then there's a spike over here, this summation actually contains two pieces to it. It contains, first of all, what might be called the summation, k equals 1. So let me just write it as the solve phase, all the finite clusters. You know, so I sum up, and in principle, this upper limit of the sum would be infinity. But if I'm just doing like a going to the continuous limit, I will only see this part of the distribution. So this solve would be a summation from k equals 1 to infinity. But it doesn't include the point that's actually at infinity. This is the same problem that you have in like just elementary integration, that if there's a singularity out at the end point, you just don't see it. So there is that term. So let's write that as k to the n, ck. But then there is the last term because of the gel, which may or may not exist. We're going to figure out when it does exist. There'll be some ck to the n, ck, associated with the gel. So this is the one last term that's not, that sort of you can think of the one term that's at infinity. So the thing is that if a gel exists, then the concentration if there's only one gel molecule out of a total of m, that means that the concentration is equal to 1 over this total mass, the total number of clusters I start with. And its size, by construction, was just equal to g times m, where g is the gel fraction. So now let's use this information to rewrite the moments of the cluster size distribution. So m1, the first moment of the cluster size distribution, so that's equal to summation kck for the solve phase. And now for the one term, which is at infinity, but in fact, if I have a finite system, infinity means just up at big M. So the size of for the first moment, k, is just equal to gm, so plus gm. But the concentration is 1 over m times 1 over m. So for the first moment, the presence of a gel, if it appears, gives a finite correction to the first moment. For the second moment, I would have the same thing. Some k squared ck, summation for the solve phase, plus. And now I take k squared, so the size is gm squared, so gm all squared divided by m. And similarly for the nth moment, just let's do in general. So I'm going to have summation k to the power n ck sol plus gm to the power n divided by m. And the point here is that for the first moment, this term is just equal to g. It's just a finite number. It's like some fraction that's between 0 and 1. Oftentimes, it's 0 when I'm in the solve phase. But if a gel appears, then it's going to be bigger than 0. This guy is equal to g squared m. And in the limit, as m goes to infinity, as I make my system larger and larger, if a gel exists, the second moment blows up. So the point here is that all moments beyond the first blow up when I reach the gelation point. And so this is a simpler way, it's a very simple argument to show that something funky happens to the cluster mass distribution whenever a gel happens to exist. The last point about this is now let's use this equation to actually infer from the exact solution of the generating function to infer what is the gel fraction. Because so far, this line of reasoning is saying, if a gel exists, something funky happens. Now let me show you that a gel actually does exist as a function of time. So let's now study the gel fraction. So let's take our equation here. And so again, E was this exponential argument. So E at y equals 1 and t is nothing more than summation k ck. Right? Because when I set y equals 0. Y equals 0. So I just have some k ck. But now here, this we have to interpret with a little bit of care, because what we see now is that the sum k ck, let's just look at this. This chalk is dying on me. Let's just rewrite this equation slightly differently. So by construction, the first moment, the sum of k ck over everything is just the total mass in the system. So the left-hand side of the equation is 1. The right-hand side is equal to summation k ck summed over the sol phase plus g. So it's like a trivial mathematical equation, but it's burying inside of it some subtlety, because one has to understand properly the meaning of this sum. It's a sum that goes from 1 to infinity, but doesn't include the one term that's actually at infinity. So the point here is that this sum k ck, which is what appears here, is precisely equal to 1 minus g. And now with this information, we can solve for the gel fraction in this aggregation process. So what I have here then is that E, so at y equals 0, this equation, so E is 1 minus g. E to the minus 1 minus g t is equal to E to the y, but y is 0, so that goes away, e to the minus t. And now let's just play a little bit with this equation. So we have an e to the minus t, which cancels over here. So let's cancel this guy away. Then put the e to the minus, this is e to the gt, and I put it on that side, becomes e to the minus gt. And then I have 1 minus g is e to the minus gt, or g is equal to 1 minus e to the minus gt. So this is the equation for the gel fraction as a function of time. And let me just ask, how many people are familiar with the mean field theory of phase transitions, the Curie-Weiss theory, where you have the self-consistent equation? Everyone, you know, so think about, let me write down an equation. M is equal to hyperbolic tanh beta JZM. Do people recognize this equation? Some people, they are supposed to recognize this equation. So in equilibrium phase transitions, there's something called the Landau, well, the Curie-Weiss theory of phase transitions, where you can compute the magnetization, the spontaneous magnetization of an ferromagnet in a self-consistent fashion by this equation, which says that the magnetization is equal to the hyperbolic tanh of an effective field, which is in turn determined by the magnetization itself. This is a transcendental equation which you generally cannot solve, but you solve it graphically. And this equation turns out to have different behaviors, whether the temperature is above, at, or below the critical temperature. Above the critical temperature, the only solution is m equals 0. Below the critical temperature, there are two solutions, m equals 0 and the equilibrium magnetization. This problem, this gelation process, has exactly the same feature that this equation. Again, it's a transcendental equation, so you can't solve it analytically. But if you look at it graphically, it has very different characters depending on whether t is less than or bigger than 1. So let's look for t. So let me plot both sides of this equation. So here is, I'm plotting as a function of g, the left-hand side and the right-hand side. So the left-hand side of the equation is just g. So that's just a straight line. So that's the left-hand side. The right-hand side, well, when g is equal to 0, then this is just 0. And you see that as g goes to infinity, this thing goes to 1. So the function of the right-hand side is starting here at 0 and is going up to 1. How quickly does it go up to 1? And that depends on the value of time. If time is less than 1, then this thing looks like that. So this is for t less than 1. So the only solution is down here. The gel fraction is equal to 0. On the other hand, if the time is larger than 1, then the initial slope of this function, if you expand for small g, then the initial slope is actually proportional to t, and so it does something like that. And so this is for t larger than 1. And so one gets a gel fraction, which is non-zero. So if one plots as a function of time, the gel fraction as a function of time, it starts off 0, 0, 0, it stays 0 until you reach 1. And then it does something like that. And so here's an example of a geometrical phase transition where the gel fraction stays 0 until you reach the critical point, and then it just grows, and ultimately the gel fraction becomes everything, and so this thing will saturate to a value of 1 off of t going to infinity. Yes?
Mathematically, it's a step function.
Pardon me?
Mathematically, it's a step function.
No, no. Mathematically, this is a second order phase transition, so it's continuous. And so, in fact, one can calculate, you know, how quickly does this rise? And so, in fact, I didn't, my artistry kind of is lousy here, but it comes in with linearly. So it comes in with a finite slope. And so the critical exponent associated with this is 1.
So is this phase transition actually like related to the 1 in the Ising
moment? Say it again?
Is the phase transition actually related to the 1 in the Ising
moment? No, it is not. I mean, this is actually much more related to the percolation transition. Have you heard of this terminology?
I don't know much about it, but I've heard of it.
OK. So the thing is that this is a purely geometrical phase transition, because the way you can think about gelation is that, you know, think about taking a very large lattice and putting little points or little balls on the lattice and saying that two balls that are nearest neighbor are connected and make a cluster. And as you increase the density of these balls, the cluster size grows and grows. And at a critical threshold, critical concentration, there will be an infinite cluster that spans the system. And that infinite cluster that spans the system has the same character as this gelation transition in this kinetic problem. So the percolation transition is just the geometrical element of the gelation transition. And so in percolation, there is something called, like in the Ising model, the order parameter, whether you are in the ordered state or the disordered state, is the magnetization. In percolation, the order parameter is called the percolation, what's it called, P of P. It's the percolation fraction. It's the fraction of mass, it's in the infinite cluster. So it's exactly the same as the gel fraction. So you should think of gel fraction as like an order parameter that goes to 0 when you hit the critical, when the controlling parameter hits a critical value. And the rate at which it goes to 0 defines a critical exponent beta that in this particular case is equal to 1. Yes?
Can you have more than one gel molecule condensing out of the?
Very nice question. It turns out that generically, for this type of a process, there's only one gel molecule. But if you can make some exotic things where you can have more than one gel molecule. But in the framework of percolation, which is sort of the geometrical part of this, one can show that 6 dimensions is where something strange happens, that there's a number of infinite clusters can actually be larger than 1. Only at the percolation threshold. So I think the precise mathematical statement is that the number of infinite clusters is 1 except at PC. And at PC, or the critical concentration, and I believe it's 6 dimensions above, then at that one point only there can be a coexistence of multiple infinite clusters. It's really all very weird. I mean, I could give an entire course just on geometry of percolation itself. So I'm just giving you the first little taste of it.
Is that 6 spatial dimensions?
6 spatial dimensions. Correct. So the thing is that, like, say, in this problem of the magnetic phase transitions, one knows that 4 is the critical dimension. Above 4 dimensions, mean field theory is correct. Below 4 dimensions, you have fluctuation-dominated effects, and you have the whole non-classical exponents, and one needs the renormalization group or other techniques to calculate it. So for percolation, that critical dimension turns out to be 6 rather than 4. Pardon me? No, for gelation, it's also, well, the thing is that, first of all, this process was like in infinite dimensions, because I was just looking, there was no space, which meant that everybody could interact with everybody with equal facility. So this, in some sense, is a theory of the percolation transition in infinite spatial dimensions. And that's why I recovered the actual mean field exponent of classical percolation. So if I really want to do this in a finite dimensional system, then I'd have to do it that way, but then that's not described by this master equation approach. Well, we really have to have a lattice and put clusters in a lattice and have them move around diffusively and have them interact. And that's typically studied by numerical simulations. Okay. So that's the first thing I wanted to accomplish today. The second thing that I want to do is spend a little bit of time describing the scaling theory of aggregation. So what is the motivation for the scaling approach? There are two points. First of all, you may remember from my very first lecture, the very first thing I did is I wrote down the scaling solution for the diffusion equation. And the point was that if you didn't know how to solve a partial differential equation, then the scaling approach allows you to essentially solve for everything by reducing a partial differential equation to an ordinary differential equation. The same approach also works here in aggregation kinetics, that we can reduce a complicated partial differential integral equation into something simpler by the scaling approach. A second motivation for the scaling approach is that, as we've seen, the constant kernel case is something which hopefully, if you all sat down and worked for a couple hours, you would know how to derive everything here. It wouldn't be very hard. By the time you get to the product kernel, this starts getting very hairy, and it might take you a week to feel comfortable with the solution here. So if I start doing other processes with even more complex reaction rates, it's basically hopeless. And in fact, the range of exactly soluble models in aggregation kinetics is really quite small. So one wants a method which is more general, and you get some physical information without having to go through the horror of solving some very complicated set of master equations. So the scaling approach is an attempt to try and avoid a lot of the mathematical detail by incorporating some physical insight to reduce the master equations to something simpler. So the scaling approach is based on the following observation. Again, Ck of t is our basic observable. And what I'd like to argue is that if there is continuous aggregation, then the mass distribution, the peak of the mass distribution is moving further and further to larger and larger sizes. So if I look at a later time, the mass distribution looks as, or if I look at two different times, so maybe let me just make a little plot here. If this is, say, Ck of t as a function of k, so at early time, maybe it's here at small mass. This is t1. A little bit later on, it's not going to grow. The integral is conserved. So maybe here it is at t2. And then maybe at t3, it's doing something like this. So if I imagine changing my mass scale, I rescale the mass so that I try and make these things all lie on top of each other, it turns out that by an appropriate scaling of the mass, I can make these mass distributions all lie on top of each other. And this is the basis of the scaling approach, which is to try and find the appropriate scaling of time and size so that I make all the curves overlap. So what I'd like to argue is that in the long time limit, this thing should be some function, not of k and t separately, but some function of k divided by a characteristic size that I have to calculate. But if I know how the characteristic size depends on time, then I essentially find that there's a natural variable here, the size divided by the typical size at a particular time. So the point here is that, here my characteristic size is S1, here my characteristic size is S2, and here my characteristic size is S3. And you see that just almost by cartoon, that the characteristic natural variable here is the size divided by the characteristic size in each of these cases. Yes?
So what justifies the assumption that scaling would actually
Well, the one important point in justifying the assumption is that if this goes continuously and it goes off to infinity, so that means there's no, that this natural scale just diverges, then you can apply the scaling approach. So that's really all there is to it, is that it's a hope based on many examples in these many body processes where when you have a diverging time scale or a diverging length scale, one sees that this scaling process, the scaling phenomenon happens, and so it's so common that one invokes it for these sorts of processes. So I can't prove it, but I can just say that it's a hope which is very much based on many observations that show it's a correct assumption. Anyways, the thing is that there's one thing which is wrong with this assumption, which is that, as I mentioned in the first lecture, this distribution as written is not properly normalized. And so let me properly normalize it by putting a 1 over s squared in front. And why do we put this in front? Because we want some kck should be equal to 1. And in scaling units, that transforms into saying that the integral of kck, which is 1 over s squared, f of k over s dk, that has to equal 1. And you see that by putting the 1 over s squared here, I can put 1 power of s with this guy, 1 power of s with this guy. And so this just transforms to the integral of u, f of u, du, which is manifestly a number of order 1. So that's why there's a 1 over s squared sitting out in front. So that's point number one, is that there is this assumption, the scaling. I mean, in reality, it's just an assumption. But you know, we physicists like to try and hide our ignorance, so we call it the scaling Ansatz. It sounds fancier. It sounds a little bit more grounded in reality because it's a German word. But it's just an assumption. So that's the scaling Ansatz. A second point is that we have to now make some assumptions about the reaction rates, so Kij. And I want to make the minimal possible assumptions about the reaction rates with which I can then extract some information. And it turns out that the most minimal assumption that you can make is a notion of homogeneity. So Kij is homogeneous. And what do I mean by homogeneous? I mean that if I take all masses and multiply by some factor A, that what is the reaction rate K of AI times AJ? And it turns out that for all examples that you can think of that are physically reasonable, that this is equal to A to the power lambda KIJ. So here, lambda is called the homogeneity index. Homogeneity index. Index. And so in terms of the homogeneity index, like for example, constant kernel lambda is equal to 0, right? Because if I change all masses, since the kernel is constant, if I just scale all masses by some factor, the reaction rate didn't change. On the other hand, for Kij equals ij, if I multiply all masses by a factor of 10, then the reaction rate will grow by a factor of 100. So in the case of Kij equal constant, the homogeneity index is equal to 0. For Kij equals ij, the homogeneity index is equal to 2. And you see that for homogeneity index equals 0, we had smooth evolution. For homogeneity index equals 2, we had this weird evolution. So it seems like the homogeneity index itself actually played an important role. And we're going to see that there is this critical value of the homogeneity index, which in which the nature of the aggregation process changes character. Now, it turns out that it's much more useful to characterize this reaction rate by writing out a matrix. So let me write out the Kij matrix. So in principle, this is an infinite dimensional by infinite dimensional matrix, in all, you know, because it goes from 1 to infinity. And so since I can't really draw an infinite dimensional matrix, I'll kind of draw it this way as a finite matrix. And it turns out there's a natural division of the matrix in the following way. In the upper left-hand corner, this is where small clusters interact with other small clusters. So pictorially, I'll write this as small, small. Along these little bands here, I have small in one index and large in the other index. And so this is where small and large clusters interact. Here, large and small interact. And then out here, as I go off to infinity, this is where large, large interactions win out, or that's where they live. And it turns out that there are three generic types of behavior that depend on whether these guys are important, these guys are important, or these guys are important. And you know, physicists, as you may appreciate, some of us are nerds. And nerds are not very good at Madison Avenue advertising. And so the way that we characterize this is like by the completely boring and useless terminology of the so-called class 1, class 2, and class 3. Those are the three basic types of phenomenology that occur. And so now let me just tell you some facts, and then I'm going to turn to deriving some parts of these facts momentarily. So in class 1, this is where large interactions dominate over large-small and small-small. And an example of this is Kij is equal to Ij. In this case, you see that the reaction rate of a tenmer with a tenmer is 100 times the interaction rate of a monomer with a monomer. So this part of the reaction matrix is huge compared to everybody up here. And physically, what's happening is that if there's any large clusters, they're reacting so quickly, they become even larger still. And if there's anybody left behind, left in the dust, like the little monomers, well, they don't react very quickly at all. And the upshot of all of this is that if there's anybody left at the low end of the distribution, they tend to stay there, and one gets a distribution as a function of k, which is rapidly decaying as a function of mass. So this is the generic behavior of the so-called type 1 or class 1 systems. Type 3 is just the opposite. Large-small wins out over large-large. And in fact, on the when was it? Yesterday, when I first presented aggregation kinetics, remember that for Brownian aggregation, that the matrix of reaction rates, Kij, was equal to 2 plus I over j to the 1/3 plus j over I to the power 1/3. So in this particular instance, if one of I is large and j is small, then the reaction rate is very large. Whereas if both they're both large, if both I and j are large, then these factors are of order 1. So in this particular case, an interaction with a large cluster with a small cluster dominates over everything else. So this part of the matrix actually wins out. And the point here is, what happens in this particular case? Well, if I look at the cluster mass distribution, well, if there is any small cluster that happens to still be alive as the process develops, then it's going to be quickly swallowed up by a very large cluster. So any large clusters that remain are quickly removed, and one gets typically cluster mass distributions that look like this. By the way, as a challenge, I should mention that if you can solve a Brownian aggregation kernel, you will get a full professorship in mathematical physics at any major university in the world, because this is a problem that many people have worked on very hard and have failed in finding it. And maybe people believe it's not even possible to find it. So it's like kind of like the 3D Ising model. It's just a really hard problem. Anyways, type 2 is where large-large is of the order of large-small. And in this particular case, when the entire matrix of reaction rates is all similar order of magnitude, this marginal case is where the most interesting things happen. And so all I can say here is that we really don't understand everything there is to know about the cluster mass distribution. And one thing about that that's a little bit paradoxical is that you see that the simplest case, Kij equals 2, constant kernel, falls in this class. And the point here is that if I just perturb the constant kernel by a little bit, then all hell breaks loose. And basically, it's not understood what is the asymptotic behavior of aggregation in these cases. OK, so now with that little preamble of just the generic behavior, let's now turn to applying the scaling ansatz to simplify the master equation for aggregation. So yeah, ask away.
Can we associate a homogeneity index to class 3?
To what? Class 3. Well, for this example, this is also homogeneity index 0. So the thing is that, in fact, there's, let me maybe put 2, you know, this is like 2a, the homogeneity index. There's a second index, 2b. K, if I look at K1j, this scales like j to the power nu. It turns out that for most physical processes, you can find that you can characterize them by a second index, which is essentially measuring the relative effect of small-large interactions. So the two natural parameters to describe aggregation in general is this homogeneity index lambda and this index mu, or nu. And so in this particular case, the homogeneity index is 0, so it's the same as the constant kernel. But this index, which is a measure of the effect of large-small interactions, is very different for the two. And so this is a secondary, I mean, it's a second piece of classification information that then you can use to study the different models. Yes?
Yeah, I've always called Brownian aggregation.
Because we're talking about diffusing particles in solution. Remember here that this Kij came from something that looked like di plus dj, ri plus rj in three dimensions. So this is precisely reaction rate of two diffusing particles that are diffusing in three-dimensional space. And so that's why we call it Brownian aggregation, because it's Brownian particles that are actually doing the moving around. Anything else? OK. So let's now apply this scaling ansatz to the master equations. And the process that I'm going to be following here is exactly the same as what I did the very first thing I did on Monday morning, which is to solve the diffusion equation by the scaling ansatz. So let's first of all write down the master equation. For aggregation. But the thing is that if we're talking about the scaling theory, we're thinking in the limit where the masses are over, can be infinitely large, in which case we can replace the discrete summation by continuous integral. It's just simpler that way. So let me now write Cxt dot. And so I'll write this as 1/2. And then I have integral from 0 up to x, ky, x minus y, cyt, cxt. That's the gain term. So look, this is just kij, ci, cj, but now I've written it as a y and an x minus y they meet. And the sum of them, whoops, this is y times x minus y at time t. So when I have a cluster of mass y and a cluster of mass x minus y meeting, then we'll create a cluster of mass x. So this is precisely the gain term. And then there is a loss term where I have an integral from 0 to infinity of k x y c x t c y t dy. And there's a loss of x because x meets anybody and is carried away. So here is my rate equation. And so it's a, let's even be a little bit more pedantic here. Let me write it as partial derivative because that's what it is. So it's a partial differential integral equation. Doesn't look like any fun to solve. But the thing is that we can get partial information with almost no work and more complete information with somewhat more work. But we're going to simplify this into two ordinary ordinary equations that we'll analyze separately. Yes? Oh, I'm sorry. I'm integrating dy. So y goes anywhere between 0 and x. OK. So. Let's maybe do a little worksheet over here. Let's compute dc by dt, assuming the scaling ansatz. So I'm going to say, let's assume that c is the scaling form. And let's compute the derivative. So when I calculate the derivative, so I'm going to get, so I differentiate the s squared out in front, I'll get minus 2 over s cubed s dot times f of k over s. And then there's a term where I differentiate inside of the argument to the f. So I'm going to get plus 1 over s squared f prime of the argument. And so let me call the argument u, just so that I have to write less here. So this is u. And then I have to differentiate the argument itself. So I'm going to get k over s squared s dot, and with the minus sign. And so when we gather everything together, we're going to get minus. Because both comes with a minus sign. And here, notice that I have k over s to the power 4th. But 1 power of k over s I can write as the scaling variable k over s. And so I'm going to have minus 1 over s cubed times s dot. And then here I have 2f plus uf prime. So that's the left-hand side of the equation. On the right-hand side, let's now also make the scaling ansatz. So here we're going to get minus s dot over s cubed 2f plus uf prime is equal to. And so here, let's write this 1 half, 0 to infinity. Let me just do the second term because it's just easier mechanically, but everything is true also in the first term. So for the second term, I'm going to write this as 1 over s squared times some function of x over s, 1 over s squared times some function of y over s, and then I have dy. And then I have kxy. But now I use the fact, the homogeneity index says that kx, k of ax, ay, is equal to a to the lambda kxy. So in particular, let me turn this backwards, right? This is kxy. And let me put here 1 over s to the power lambda is equal to k of x over s, y over s. So whenever I see kxy, I can replace this by s to the minus lambda k x over s, y over s. And then here I have a 1 over s fourth from these two guys. And I have f of x over s, f of y over s. And here, let me make this d of y over s. By the way, I said s fourth. And I wrote 3. So why did I do that? I have no idea why, but it's 4. And then here I write dy over s and then times s. The why I did all of this is that now I've expressed the integrand in terms of scaled variables. So the thing is that let's pull out everything that, let's pull out over, so what we're going to get here, we have this integral. So now I have minus the integral. Well, let's pull out the factors of s. So there's an s. There's an s to the minus 3 minus lambda out in front. Then I have k. And now let me call x over s. Let's just call it u. Let's call y over s v. So I have kuv, fu, fv. Fu, that sounds a little bad. But dy, so dv. And the integral goes from 0 to infinity. Notice that all of the s dependence is pulled outside of this integral. There's no more s dependence. This has no more s. It only has the scaled variable u or v. And so this is accomplishing the separation of variables that underlies the whole scaling ansatz. So at the end of the day, let me just now, because you see I can do the same thing for this term. And so what I'm going to get at the end of all of this is I'm going to get minus s. So let's write it this way, 1 over s to the 3 plus lambda. That's a common factor for both of these guys. They'll have the same scaling with s. And then I have some horrible object, k. Well, let me write it I of u. It's some horrible integral that depends only on the scaling variable u. Here, in this case, we integrate over all v, and what's left is a function of u. Similarly here, there'll only be left a function of u only. So now what we do is like what you've learned in the elementary differential equations. Let's put all of the s dependence on one side, all of the u dependence on another side, and let's see what we get from all of that. So first of all, the s to the 3 cancels everywhere, and I'm going to get minus s dot s to the power lambda is equal to I of u divided by 2f plus u f prime. That's my equation now. And remember back in the very first days when you're learning differential equations and separation of variables, you say, well, this side is a function of time only, because s is a function of time only. This side is a function of u only, which is equal to k, you know, it's a scaled variable. So because this is a these two sides are functions of independent variables, they most separately have to be equal to a constant. And so equals to a constant. Let's call that the separation constant lambda. And in fact, let me put minus sign here, because I do know that the characteristic size is growing with time. And in order to have a growing with time behavior, I want to put a minus sign. So the equation for s itself will be something that grows with time. So for the S dependence, we have S dot S to the lambda is equal to capital lambda. And for the U dependence, I have this I of U over 2F plus UF prime is equal to minus lambda. This equation is very hard to deal with because it's still an integral equation. But you can make some progress. But for the purposes of just, you know, for the rest of this lecture, let's just focus on this, because already from here we learned some very non-trivial results. So let's solve this equation. S dot S to the lambda is equal to a constant. And so this guy has three possible solutions depending on the value of lambda. And so it turns out, I mean, little lambda. So it matters whether lambda is less than 1, lambda is larger than 1, or lambda is equal to 1. Question?
We're just noticing that I think you made an error in the.
It's very likely.
S to the minus lambda?
S to the minus lambda, S to the minus lambda.
Because when you, when you change, it should be S to the plus lambda in the integral, so when you bring it to the other side, it should be S to the minus lambda.
This is S to the minus lambda.
That should be S to the plus lambda.
This is S to the plus lambda here?
What?
Well, first of all, now that I look at this, you're obviously right. I've made a mistake. It's just I don't see where I made
when
it.
When you change k of x, y to s to the minus lambda k of x over s, it should be s to the plus lambda.
Okay. Thank you very much, because otherwise I'd be screwed. So thank you. So plus lambda here. So this becomes minus 3. So okay, so this is minus lambda here. And then we have this. And this looks a lot better, actually. So thank you for pointing that out. So the thing is that for s lambda equals 1, the equation is that s dot is proportional to s, which means that s goes as e to the t, exponential growth. Here we have s dot is proportional to s to the power lambda. And if lambda is less than 1, the solution to this is that s scales as t to the 1 divided by 1 minus lambda. For lambda larger than 1, then we get that S scales as basically 1 over T TC minus T to the power, I've forgotten. Sorry. I don't pay attention to this one very much, so I forgot. So this is some.
Power
1 in the notes. Fine. OK. So anyways, that is the behavior of the characteristic size. So the size grows as a power law in time indefinitely and only diverges as t goes to infinity. When lambda is equal to 1, you get a different behavior, exponential growth. And beyond this point, lambda larger than 1, this is where you get a gelation transition. So it turns out that this gelation transition that we found for this product kernel aggregation actually would work for any kind of a model, ij to the power omega. If omega is larger than 1/2, one would get the same type of gelation phenomenon. And by the way, nobody has solved this model for anything except omega is equal to 1. So there's a whole host of open questions here about how to solve these models that's occupied a lot of very brilliant mathematical physicists. And we still don't know the answers. And any questions so far? Yes?
Are the higher values of omega, is it relevant, I guess?
Higher omegas?
Right.
Well, so the case of ij to the power 1, I could justify by thinking of, like, you know, monomers are made up of more than 2 gravity arms. And then the number of arms grows basically linear with the size of the object. But to justify other types of kernels, you have to look at the microscopics of the process. But typically, gravitational accretion processes seem to involve reaction rates which have very high powers of mass inside of them. But the other thing which also is a little bit weird is that if this is ij to the power, I forget what the answer was, that if this becomes too rapidly growing with mass, then there's a phenomenon called instantaneous gelation. The system is so pathological that it explodes instantly. And so there's all kinds of weird pathologies that are probably more in the domain of mathematicians and physicists, because they don't exist in any, we don't see physical reactions exploding immediately. But nevertheless, there's all kinds of weird pathologies with them. So when, depending on the indices, lambda and the secondary index nu, there's many different types of behaviors that can actually arise. All right, so now I have about 15 minutes left, and I want to spend this last 15 minutes talking about a physical process of aggregation with input. And this is maybe a more industrial type of process where you imagine, for example, so let's now plot again as a function of size, the cluster mass distribution. And what I have in mind here is that I'm feeding in clusters at the monomer scale, for example, and then the process aggregates, and there'll be some cluster mass distribution which develops, and then this tail here will just go off to infinity eventually. But the picture you should have in mind is a cascade-like picture that you feed in stuff at the small size, you process it, it makes larger and larger masses, and like, you know, if you think about like you're at the Dairy Queen and you pour in the milk and you pour in the ice cream and then you mix it up and then you pull out of the far end of the blizzard that you have on this, in the summer. So what we have in mind here is an industrial process that you feed in monomers, you process, you make something that you then pull out of the reaction, and you run this in a steady state operation. And the question you might want to ask then, what is the form of Ck at infinite time when the system goes to a steady state, if it actually goes to a steady state? So this is the question I want to address in the remaining few minutes. I just want to also mention that there's a very important analogy with something that maybe you've heard of before called the Kolmogorov scaling theory of turbulence. How many people have heard that terminology? So in Kolmogorov scaling, what one has is, as a function of wave number, one has an energy density. And the idea here is, like, think about that you're in your canoe or rowboat and you pull with your paddle and you make big eddies in the water. And these eddies, by the nonlinear interaction of the Navier-Stokes equations, interact among themselves and make smaller and smaller eddies, and it goes smaller and smaller. And there's even a poem written about it. I forget the name of the poem, but you can find it on the web. And the point is that you feed in energy at the largest length scale, which is the smallest wave number scale, and then you end up with an energy spectrum which has, at least according to Kolmogorov of 1941 scaling, a k to the minus 5/3 spectrum. And in fact, one can wave one's hands with not very much waving necessary to derive this k to the minus 5/3 spectrum in like two lines. So the thing is that there's a nice analogy between aggregation with input and Kolmogorov scaling, and it's worth being aware that this analogy exists. And if you don't know how to derive this k to the minus 5/3, if there's time, I'll show you how to do it, because it's really just dimensional analysis in two lines. OK, so first let's talk about aggregation with input. And again, to keep the discussion as simple as possible, let's talk only about constant kernel aggregation, and let's only worry about what happens in the steady state. So our equation of motion is Ck dot is equal to summation prime Ci Cj minus 2 sum Ci times n, where n was a total number of clusters. So that was the aggregation. In the case of irreversible aggregation, then there was nothing being put in. But now I'm going to put an input. And let's do the simplest thing, where I'm going to input monomer. So I'm going to input monomer. So there's the monomer equation has an extra term because I'm inputting monomers. And let's put them in at rate 1. And you're welcome to put in with an arbitrary rate and see what is the effect of changing the rate. And I want to look at the steady state. So I'm going to set this thing equal to 0. So that's the steady state equation. So that's what we want to solve. So how do we deal with this equation? What we do is the generating function. Let's take this equation, multiply by z to the power k, and sum from k equals 1 to infinity. And let's see what happens. So for the first term, by summing over all k, the restricted sum on I and j now becomes two independent unrestricted sums. And I write here zk is the same as zi plus j. And so I have Ci, Zi, Cj, Zj. So I'm just going to have here C squared. So 0 is equal to C squared. Then the next term is minus 2. So sum my notation is bad here. I made a little mistake here. This should be CK. Because it's K-mers that are lost, so they interact with anybody. So anyways, in this case, I'll get minus 2C. And then I have N, which is nothing more than the generating function at Z equals 1. So this is C of 1. And then I have plus. Here, I'll just get Z. So that's my equation for the generating function. And again, just as before, this is not a closed equation because we have C as a function of Z, which involves C at 1. But we can resolve that by just solving for C of 1. So C of 1 squared minus 2 C of 1 squared is equal plus 1. That's equal to 0. So if we subtract these two equations and again define our friend C minus, which is equal to C minus C of 1, then what we get is when I subtract these two So I'll subtract these two equations, then I'm going to get C minus C of 1 squared is equal to, or plus, Z minus 1 is equal to 0. Now, the thing is that what is C of 1? Well, from this equation, I'm going to get C of 1 squared is equal to 1. So C of 1 is just equal to 1. So putting this all together, I'm going to get an equation C of Z is equal to 1 minus the square root of 1 minus Z. So that is my final answer for the generating function. Now, what we need to do then is we want to invert this generating function to get the mass distribution. And again, once you're familiar with Laplace transforms and generating function technology, you can actually just write this down with no work. What is the inversion of this generating function? But you know, you're not at that stage yet, so let me just give you a little bit of hints about how to infer from this what is the mass distribution. So again, the tricks that I'm about to show you are one of these things that you know, you have to be over 18 years old to actually view it, because it's a little bit dangerous. And so I'm going to do some very simple-minded approximations with which to estimate this thing. So again, the thing is that recall from lecture one that I did some stunts like this, which is that if I wanted to compute the generating function, something like ck z to the k, I would write this as something like integral ck e to the minus ks ds, where I'm assuming here that s is equal to logarithm s is equal to minus log of, I have problems with this, e to the k log z. Yeah, so s is equal to minus k log z. So evaluating the generating function is nothing more than just evaluating the Laplace transform. Now, what we saw last time, or two times ago, was that if the integral of c, I'm sorry, this is integral dk. Yes. If the integral of ck dk, if it diverged, everything was fine. You could be very sloppy and get an answer. If the integral ck dk converged, I'd never even talked about that case in the first lecture. And I want to now deal with that case, because, well, let me just tell you what the answer is here. It turns out that ck at t equals infinity asymptotically scales as k to the minus 3/2. And you see that if I integrate ck over all k, this is a convergent integral. And so, you know, in lecture one, I said, oh, when the integral diverges, you can be sloppy. When the integral converges, we have to do something else. You had a question. Minus log z. Oh, z. I'm in Canada. I should be true to my own country. OK, anyways. So what happens if ck, so if ck, if the integral ck converges? So what I'm going to do then is that, you know, so this was my generating function, c of z. And in fact, I know that C at 1, I just erased it, C at 1 was equal to 1. So let's calculate, instead of C of Z, let's look at, and let me do it the same way as my notes, wherever it is. Yeah, so let's consider 1 minus C of Z, which is the same as C of 1 minus C of Z. Let's look at that guy. So this is just following the chain of reasoning here. If I put a C of 1, that's putting Z equals 1 here. And so what I'm going to get at the end is CK 1 minus e to the minus KS dK. Now, if you remember, in the lecture number 1, I said, well, this is a function that decayed exponentially. And I replaced exponential decay just by that. I'm going to do the same thing here. This is a function which looks something like this. It grows to 1 exponentially. So I'm just going to replace it by that. As simple can possibly be. So if I do this replacement, then what I'm going to get is I rub out the integrand, all of this stuff, and I say this is the integrand, which is 0 up to 1 over s to infinity ck dk. Now let's suppose that if ck scales as k to the minus mu, and mu has to be larger than 1 in order for the integral to converge, then this integral is nothing more than what? So it's the integral of k to the minus mu dk from 1 over s to infinity. And so I'm going to get k to the 1 minus mu, so I'm going to get s to the mu minus 1. But s, I had here that that s is equal to log of z. So when s is going to, s was equal to minus log of z. And the thing is that notice here that this thing becomes singular when z is approaching 1. Z approaching 1 is like s going to 0. So s going to 0 is like z going to 1. And the point here is that we see s to the mu minus 1. So this thing, as z goes to 1, is like s going to 0. This is like the same as the square root of s. So I have square root of s, which means here that mu is equal to 3 halves. And that's it. So I found, in fact, this exponent 3 halves just by computing the generating function and, again, applying asymptotic tricks to estimate the Laplace transform without doing any integral. And then I find, in the end, that this exact form for the generating function corresponds to a k to the minus 3 halves tail for the mass distribution. Now, I'm supposed to finish at 12:05, and according to my watch, I've got 90 more seconds to go. So let me, if I may, just take some poetic license, and let me derive this for you. Because how many people have heard of this again? How many people know how to derive it? Okay. So the thing about this Kolmogorov scaling is, first of all, it's called Kolmogorov 1941 scaling. And if you think about what was going on in the world in 1941, it's amazing that some incredibly beautiful mathematical physics was being solved by a Russian mathematician in 41. What I don't know is whether it was before June 22nd or after June 22nd. Yes?
I don't know the answer, although I tried to look for the web.
Yes.
Because,
you know, June 22nd is when Hitler invaded Russia, and so that's when all hell broke loose. But
yeah, but unfortunately, I couldn't find the corresponding reference.
Yeah. Okay. Anyways, let's derive this k to the minus 5/3. So the thing is that the idea of Kolmogorov scaling is kind of like aggregation with input. You're feeding in energy at some large scale. You're developing a time-independent energy distribution. And so the feed-in process, how do we characterize it? The natural way to characterize the feed-in is the amount of energy being fed in per unit time, per unit mass of the object. So let me call epsilon. Will be the energy input per unit mass per unit time. Because, you know, I'm paddling my paddle and I'm pushing some water, And to have a normalized measure, if I have twice as much water, I should have twice as big a paddle. And so I want energy input per unit mass per unit time. What is the units of this thing? The units of this thing, well, energy divided by mass, I get rid of the mass. Energy is velocity squared divided by time. So this is equal to length squared over t cubed. That's the units of the energy input. Now, the thing is that here we're looking at the energy spectrum in k space. And what I'm looking for is a region of k space. Here's dk. And I want to compute how much energy is in this region of phase space. And it should be the same, you know, like there's going to be whatever is being fed in here and then is leaving the system over here. So the other natural thing here is the energy spectrum dk. This is going to be the total amount of energy that lives in this region of wave number space. And so what is the units of this thing? And so what I let me define this. This will be the energy. Let me see if I can spell energy. Energy per unit mass between k and k plus dk. So energy per unit mass is, again, a velocity. So it's length squared over t cubed. But I have energy between k and k plus dk. But k is inverse, is wave number, which is inverse length. And so the dk gives me another factor of this. Sorry. Energy per unit mass is length squared over t squared. But dk is an is that an inverse length? K is 1 over length. Yeah, OK, so this is an inverse length. So this is L. Fine. So E of K, so I guess what I want to say here is that E of K is equal to the energy in K, K plus dK, I got this backwards, per unit mass. And I want to divide here by dK. That's what E of K is. So this object, this is what I want, is equal to length squared over t squared, but with dk downstairs, so it's L cubed. So those are the two things that I'm now going to use. So finally, I want to now compute this energy spectrum. I want to get k to the minus 5/3 out of the spectrum. So Ek has units of L cubed over t squared. The only thing which appears here is the energy input. There's nothing else. So the crucial fact here is that there is a so-called, the jargon here is called the inertial range. Inertial range. Below the inertial range is where you're feeding in the energy input. Out here, viscous effects kill all eddies. You know, like once I get to really tiny scales, viscosity kills all eddies, and you don't see eddies at a scale of microns anymore. So turbulence and eddies occurring on this inertial range, which is typically a large length scale. But once I'm in this inertial range, there are no other scales in the problem. And the only parameter that I have to deal with here is my energy input. But you see here that the energy input has time cubed. So the only way I'm going to get time squared is that this thing should be proportional to epsilon to the power 2/3. I must have that. But if I take epsilon to the power 2/3, and now I'm 30 seconds from the end, epsilon to the 2/3. So that's equal to, in units, that's equal to L to the 4/3 times t squared. But the energy has an L cubed. The only way we're going to get an L cubed out of this is I have to multiply by something which has the units of L to the power 5/3. There's no other length in the problem. The only thing that I can form that has units of length is wave number to the minus 5/3 power. So the Kolmogorov scaling says that the energy spectrum, E of k, is proportional to epsilon to the power 2/3, k to the minus 5/3. If I could do that for aggregation, I'd be very happy. I don't know how to do that same argument of wave my hands and get k to the minus 3/2 for good old aggregation. But anyways, this is a very beautiful argument. And you know, Kolmogorov was justifiably famous for many contributions. But this was one of his more amazing ones, because this happened first of all, in a time of incredible stress in the world, and also a very simple argument that has very far-reaching ramifications. OK, I think I'm done. Lunchtime.